Today we're going to be looking at some things regarding the book of Job. And it's my experience with the study of the book of Job that most of the time is spent in the narrative portions of the book, in chapters 1 and 2, and then again all the way at the end, chapter 42, looking at kind of the story. And we talk a lot about Job's initial prosperity and his blessed condition. We think about the scenes in heaven where Satan comes into the presence of God, and God has a discussion with Satan about Job, his servant, and then the subsequent testing that Satan is allowed to do of Job, the two stages that he does with him. We focus a lot on the miserable state of Job after he suffered Satan's attacks on his finances and his family and his flesh and his friends. And we emphasize that throughout all of that, Job never turned on God. He never sinned against him. He held fast to his faith. And then we rejoice in the reward and the reestablishment of Job's prosperity in the end of the book, where we see that he has twice as much in the end as what he started out with in the beginning. We may even spend some time, though, in my experience, it's been less time focusing on what God has to say in the book of Job, which is chapters 38 through 41. And we look at that and we see how awesome God is. And we focus in on his creative power and just his awe. And we stand in wonder of how great God is. For those of us who are a little bit more intrigued by other things, we might focus in on chapters 40, or particularly chapter 41, that talks about the great description of Leviathan, right? And we think about how that could be the biblical representation of things like dinosaurs or dragons. And, you know, if you're a guy and you're into that kind of stuff, that's fascinating to you, right? That it's not just some made up thing, but that there is actual biblical evidence and record of those kinds of things. We may even look at sometimes the words of Job himself and his questioning of God and his outpouring of his soul and his feelings towards God. I mean, Job is not hesitant to put out there how he feels about his suffering and his confusion and his frustration with the circumstances that he finds himself in. And yet we point out from that it's okay as God's people, as his servants, to not feel okay with our circumstances all the time. That's not wrong. It's not a sin to have questions or to be frustrated or to have concerns that you pour out. It's not a sin to pour out your heart and your anxiety to God. In fact, that's something that he wants us to do. But we emphasize that throughout all of that, we have to have that unyielding, that unbending trust and faith in God, that he knows what's best. But I'll tell you, one of the things that I have neglected in my study of the book of Job, and something that I think is often neglected, is the counsel and advice that Job's three friends offer to him on this circumstance. He has three buddies who come to visit him: Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And let me start at the end, because something that jumped out at me this last month when we were reading through the book of Job is something that God says to these three guys in chapter 42. In Job chapter 42, beginning in verse 7, it came about after the Lord had spoken these words to Job that the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, "My wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends because you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. Now, therefore, take for yourselves 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and offer a burnt offering for yourselves. And my servant Job will pray for you, for I will accept him, so that I may not do with you according to your folly, because you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has." And I started thinking, man, that sounds pretty harsh. What was God so frustrated with them about? What had they done that caused the wrath of God to be kindled against them to such an extent that it required not only sacrifices, but also the prayers of a righteous man, Job, on their behalf in order to avoid the punishment that God was wanting to dole out to them? Well, I would suggest to you that it has something to do with what they said, what they spoke. And specifically, what they spoke about God was not right. And so I asked myself, well, what could that be? What did they speak about God that was not right, that God takes such offense here at? And more importantly, what can we learn from their encounter with God on this occasion? That's what I want to look at this morning. But first, let me begin with an observation of how Job's three friends initially interacted with him. If you go back to Job chapter 2, they're introduced in verse 11. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all his adversity that had come upon him, they came each one from his place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, and they made an appointment together to come to sympathize with Job and to comfort him. And when they lifted their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him, they raised their voices and wept, and each of them tore his robe, and he threw dust over his head toward the sky, and they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights, with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. I would suggest to you that these first 7 days of sitting in silence with Job, just being there with him as he's going through this very trying time in his life, that was perhaps the smartest and most beneficial thing that Job's three friends did for him throughout this whole ordeal, was to just sit there silently and be with him. And there's a lesson we could learn in that. Sometimes we think when we're trying to comfort somebody that we've got to have the right words to say. We got to say exactly the right thing in exactly the right way to bring peace to them. And sometimes all they need is for us to just be close by. You don't have to say a word. Just be there. Because what's interesting is that when his three friends finally do open their mouths and begin to speak, their help is not very helpful at all. In fact, Job will complain about that throughout the rest of the book, that they're not very good counselors or comforters or helpers because of the advice and counsel that they're giving him. What ends up happening is their conversation becomes a debate which morphs into a trial of Job. And each of them takes turns speaking. It begins with Job's expression of frustration at his present circumstances, even cursing the day of his birth in Job chapter 3. But then there will be three successive rounds where each friend will speak to Job and give him counsel. And after each friend speaks, Job will respond. We'll look at those speeches this morning together. What I want to do, instead of going in the order that they appear, is look at the three speeches of Eliphaz, the three speeches of Bildad, and then the two speeches of Zophar, and see what they say. Because one of the things that's interesting to me as we look at the speeches is that even though they begin gently, they all progressively get harsher and harsher and harsher, until finally Bildad just utters this like almost frustrated short little speech. But let's begin with Eliphaz's first speech, which is in Job chapter 4 and 5. And Eliphaz begins with a gentle, humble appeal. Verse 2, he says, "If one ventures a word with you, will you become impatient? But who can refrain from speaking? Behold, you've admonished many. You've strengthened weak hands. Your words have helped the tottering to stand, and you have strengthened feeble knees. But now it's come to you, and you're impatient. It touches you, and you're dismayed. Is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope?" That's kind of like, hey, Job, I mean, you've helped a lot of other people, you know, and now that you're going through some things, why don't you kind of be a little bit patient? Take some of your own advice that you used to give to others when they were suffering things. And he launches then into kind of this general observation about what happens to the wicked, that typically speaking, wicked people are the ones who suffer hardships in their lives. And then he, in verses 12 through 21, Eliphaz refers to this very obscure, this weird, strange encounter that he has with some type of spiritual being. And I would encourage you to go back and read verses 12 through 16 to see how Eliphaz describes this encounter. Most commentators and scholars that I've read say that this is a visit from a good angel that comes and gives Eliphaz this message. I'll be honest, I'm not quite so convinced that it was a good angel that came and spoke to Eliphaz, because essentially what this angel, this angelic, this spiritual being, the message that he relays to Eliphaz is that no man can be right with God, because God finds fault with everyone and everything, especially mortal man. His exact words are, can mankind be just before God? Can a man be pure before his maker? He, that is God, puts no trust even in his servants, and against his angels he charges error. How much more those who dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, who are crushed before the moth. Between morning and evening they are broken in pieces, unobserved. They perish forever. Now, if that's a good angel, that angel doesn't seem to hold a very high estimation of how God values what he's created. He seems to be saying, man has no hope, God doesn't care about man, God doesn't like anything that he created, and God finds fault with everybody, especially mortal man. But based on some of that advice that he received from a spiritual visitor or a spirit visitor, Eliphaz launches into a hypothetical fool's tragedy in chapter 5. Saying that this is the kind of tragedy that typically befalls a fool. And it seems to be some allusions to Job's situation and some of the words that he says there. But then he says, you know, if I was that guy, if I was this hypothetical fool who's suffering this tragedy, this is what I would do. I would turn to God and I would seek him, and then God would protect me from my troubles. And that's the end of Eliphaz's first speech. His second speech is found in Job chapter 15. And this time he doesn't begin quite so kindly. In fact, he begins with an accusation against Job's words. He basically tells Job, you're full of hot air. He says, should a wise man answer with windy knowledge and fill himself with the east wind? Should he argue with useless talk or with words which are not profitable? Job, you're full of a bunch of hot air in all the words that you're saying. And in the process of accusing him of this, he says that you've actually wandered away from God. Verse 4, he says, indeed, you do away with reverence and hinder meditation before God, for your guilt teaches your mouth and you choose the language of the crafty. Job, you're just trying to get out of trouble without accepting responsibility for what you've done. And he goes on to insinuate in this speech that Job is not as smart as he thinks that he is. And there's a sense in which he is correct in this, right? None of us really are as smart as we think that we are. And typically, man has a tendency to speak more than what he knows. But even though Eliphaz may be correct, when you read the way that he presents that truth to Job, it is not in a kind or loving manner at all. But it's on the basis of this assertion that Job, you're not as smart as you think you are, that he then accuses Job of turning his heart away from God. Why does your heart carry you away? Why do your eyes flash that you should turn your spirit against God and allow such words to go out of your mouth? And again, in verses 14 through 16, Eliphaz seems to be making reference to the words of that spirit visitor when he says, what is man that he should be pure, or he who is born of a woman that he should be righteous? Behold, he puts no trust in his holy ones. God doesn't even trust his holy ones. And the heavens are not pure in his sight. How much less one who is detestable and corrupt, man who drinks iniquity like water. Again, he's saying man is always unworthy and untrusted by God. So Job, who do you think that you are that God would trust you or count you as worthy in his eyes? And then more pointedly, he goes on to suggest that Job is like the wicked man who writhes in pain because he has stretched out his hand against God. And in that section, he makes a couple allusions to Job's specific calamities. The reference to the desolate cities becoming a ruin in verse 28 may be an allusion to the fact that his son's house collapsed and fell down upon all of his children, killing them. In verse 29, where he talks about the wealth of the wicked will not endure, well, certainly Job's wealth, his livestock, which is how they would have counted wealth, did not endure. It was taken by the Sabians and the Chaldeans. And again, in verse 30 and 34, he talks about this flame and this consuming fire that comes from God. And who can forget that that was how his sheep and his flocks were destroyed, was by fire coming down from heaven and consuming them. So then that brings us to Eliphaz's third speech, which is in Job chapter 22. And here, he doesn't begin with kind words or even an accusation. He begins by mocking Job's claims of righteousness. In verse 2 of chapter 22, he says, "Can a vigorous man be of use to God, or a wise man be useful to him? Is there any pleasure to the Almighty if you are righteous, or profit if you make your ways perfect? Is it because of your reverence that he reproves you and that he enters into judgment against you?" You can almost just hear the snarky way in which Eliphaz says that. Job, you're professing your righteousness and your reverence and your integrity before God. Is it because you're such a good person that God's punishing you? He's mocking him here. And he continues on. He rhetorically asks the question about the greatness and magnitude of Job's sin. He says, "Is not your wickedness great and your iniquities without end?" And he goes on then, and he launches into a bunch of specific yet unsubstantiated allegations of wrongs that Job must have done against his fellow man. "You've forsaken the widow, you've mistreated the poor, you've taken advantage of people." All things that Job would say, "I've never done any of those things." But he states then, at the end of that, that it's because, Job, you have sinned in these ways, therefore snares surround you and sudden dread terrifies you, or darkness so that you cannot see, and abundance of waters covers you. Job, you're suffering because you're a sinner. That's what Eliphaz ultimately tells Job here on this occasion. And then rhetorically he asks Job if he really thinks that he's going to be able to hide his sin forever from God. And of course, it's a rhetorical question because he basically plows right on and says, "No, Job, you're not. God sees everything and God will punish you for your wrongdoing." And then, in a somewhat maybe disingenuous way, he pleads with Job to be reasonable. "To listen to me, Job, return to God, for it will be then and only then that you'll ever have hope of being healed." So Eliphaz's speech from beginning to end start out politely and humbly, but end with out and out accusations of Job being a sinner. Bildad, on his part, is not much better. In fact, his first speech, which is found in Job chapter 8, he doesn't begin nearly as kind or gently as Eliphaz did in his first speech. In fact, Bildad begins with insults and false accusations. He accuses Job of blowing a lot of smoke, impugning Job's reverence and respect for God, and outright accusing the death of Job's sons on their own sins. Beginning in verse 2, he says, "How long will you say these things? And the words of your mouth be a mighty wind? Does God pervert justice? Or does the Almighty pervert what is right? If your sons sinned against him, then he delivered them into the power of their transgressions." Your boys died because they're sinners. And then, using this as leverage, he tries to get Job to straighten up before it's too late for you. "Job, if that's what happened to your boys, man, you better sit up and pay attention and not repeat the same mistake. Otherwise, that's the fate that will come to you as well." And he asks Job to consider from observation about the wicked and the good. He says in verse 8, "Please inquire of past generations and consider the things searched out by their fathers. For we are only of yesterday and know nothing, because our days on earth are as a shadow. But will they not teach you and tell you and bring forth words from their minds?" He says, look back on the past. And when you look back on the past, you make some general observations about the categories of people. Typically, wicked people, what happens for them? Well, nothing good. It's usually bad after bad after bad. And what happens to those who are righteous, those who are good? Well, typically, good things happen to them. And all the while, Bildad is insinuating, "Job, what's happening to you? Bad things. That means you must be a bad person." That's what observation would tell us. Bildad's second speech is not much better. It's in Job chapter 18. This time he begins with a harshly worded reality check. to Job. He basically says, Job, when you're ready to come back to reality, then we can have a rational conversation about things. He says, how long will you hunt for words? Show understanding, and then we can talk. When you're ready to be reasonable, Job, then we'll have a conversation. Why are we regarded as beasts, as stupid in your eyes? Oh, you who tear yourself in your anger, for your sake is the earth abandoned or the rock to be moved from its place? Like, Job, who do you think? You think you're so special that the earth is going to revolve around you? Come back to reality, man, and let's have a conversation, is what Bildad says here. And then he goes on to talk about what happens to the wicked. But his statements here, I find them to be at best very passively aggressive, because he seems to be pointing at things, and his comments seem to be designed to his hypothetical wicked guy that he's talking about, and what he suffers are all the things that Job is suffering. A couple specific examples. He says his skin is devoured by disease. As Job is sitting in front of him, covered with boils from the top of his head to the sole of his feet. He goes on and he says, he has no offspring or posterity among his people, nor any survivors where he has sojourned, as Job is sitting there mourning the loss of all of his children. And so again, when he gets to verse 21 and he makes the statement, surely such are the dwellings of the wicked, and this is the place of him who does not know God. The implication of that statement was not lost on Job. Job understood that what Bildad was saying was, Job, you are the wicked man who doesn't know God, because look what's happening to you. And his third speech in Job chapter 25 is, as I mentioned, the shortest of all the speeches, and chronologically, this is actually the last speech that will be given by any of his friends, because Zophar will only get a chance to give two speeches. He doesn't speak in round three. But his speech sounds to me like just an outburst of frustration. This guy's not being reasonable. And in short, he basically says, God is the most powerful being that ever was, and man will never be able to stand before him. Dominion and all belong to him who establishes peace in his heights. Is there any number of his troops, and upon whom does his light not rise? How then can a man be just with God? Or how can he be clean who is born of a woman? Even if the moon has no brightness and the stars are not pure in his sight, how much less man, that maggot, and the son of man, that worm? Job, you're getting what you should expect, because you're an unrighteous maggot and worm. Let's look at what Zophar said briefly. His first speech is found in Job chapter 11. And he actually begins by scolding Job. Basically says, Job, don't think that you can talk your way out of this one. Shall a multitude of words go unanswered and a talkative man be acquitted? Shall your boasts silence men? And shall you scoff and none rebuke? You really think you can talk your way out of this one, Job? I don't think so. You're not smarter than God. God knows that you're lying. God sees your lies. He sees your iniquity. Don't think that you can fool him or escape punishment. And then after this rather harsh scolding, Zophar offers some advice on what Job ought to do to rectify his situation. And basically his advice is, Job, if you want things to go better for you, quit sinning. Turn to God. Look to him. And then if you will look to God and stop sinning, then God will forgive you and restore you. But only after you quit your sins. And even though those words in verses 13 through 19, as you read them, sound somewhat positive, I find it interesting that he takes opportunity to get one last dig in verse 20, where he says, but the eyes of the wicked will fail, and there will be no escape for them, and their hope is to breathe their last. So in other words, Job, this is what you ought to do, bud. Stop sinning. But if you're not going to do it, then your only hope is to die. His second and last speech is found in Job chapter 20, and it really is a scathing rebuke, in which Zophar suggests that Job's prior prosperity wasn't because God had blessed him or because God had built a hedge around him, as Satan had accused. But he actually suggests that you were so prosperous because you were actually a wicked person. He says, do you know this from of old, from the establishment of man on the earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short and the joy of the godless momentary? Though his loftiness reaches the heaven and his head touches the cloud, he perishes forever like his refuse. Those who have seen him will say, where is he? Job, I'm suggesting that your prosperity up until this point is not because you were such a good guy, but it's because you were a wicked person who took advantage of everybody else. But you need to know something, bud. The prosperity of the wicked is fleeting, and eventually the bill will come due, and you have to pay. And then he goes on, and he basically flat out says, Job, what you're experiencing right now is the judgment of God against your prior wickedness. He says in chapter 20, verses 27 through 29, the heavens will reveal his iniquity, and the earth will rise up against him. The increase of his house will depart, his possessions will flow away in the day of God's anger. This is the wicked man's portion from God, even the heritage decreed to him by God. I don't know about you, but I think his three friends did a pretty bad job of comforting Job in his time of trial. And after looking at those summaries of what advice and counsel they gave him, it seems to me a little bit more reasonable, understandable, why God would be so frustrated with these three friends of Job. But I want to think for just a couple minutes about what the real issue was here. Because though they may have begun with good intentions, and though they may have started kind of more gently in suggesting, hey, Job, you might be guilty before God, you know, give some consideration to your ways. By the end, all of them are out and out declaring, Job, God thinks you are a sinner. And though they may have thought that they were right on the right track in their reasoning and their logic, they end up declaring something that I would suggest is not their right to declare. They each judged Job to be a sinner. But what's worse is that each of them spoke for God and said, God has judged you to be a sinner. And that's why all this bad stuff is happening to you. They said, God knows you're a sinner, Job, and he is causing this calamity to come upon you as a punishment for your sin. The problem with their reasoning, with their logic, with their conclusion, is that they were completely wrong in their judgment of Job. Really, they were wrong about declaring what God thought about his servant, Job. In fact, their conclusion, their declaration of what God thought about Job couldn't have been further from the truth. You remember what God said about Job when he was talking to Satan in chapter 1. He says, have you considered my servant, Job? There's no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. And even after the first round of torment that Satan brought upon him in chapter 2, God says essentially the same thing. Have you considered my servant Job? For there's no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. And he still holds fast his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without cause. He says, I love that guy. He is my servant. And he is a faithful servant of mine. He holds in his integrity. He is unwavering in his commitment to me. He is righteous and blameless when compared to everybody else in his generation. And yet all of his friends said, Job, obviously you are not right with God. And I would suggest to you that this is the issue that God had with Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. They presumed to declare what God's judgment was on Job, when that was in fact not God's judgment against Job. They spoke for God something that God had not spoken for himself. They declared Job to be a sinner before God when this was not in fact God's judgment of Job. Well, what can we learn from this? I would suggest to you there's a great deal that we can learn, but a very valuable lesson that we can learn from these three friends of Job is a lesson about how we judge one another as brethren. It's very easy for us to look at our brethren and judge them to be falling short of God's grace. We're often quick to label or declare, sometimes openly and sometimes privately behind their back, that a brother or sister is in error or guilty of sin. And sometimes we make that determination on the same inconclusive criteria that Job's friends use, their present physical circumstance. We say, oh man, bad stuff is happening in their life. They must be doing something wrong. And God is punishing them. God's trying to get their attention. Other times we just judge them to be sinners because they simply do things that are different than the way that we do things. Or the way, more accurately, that I do things. And we need to remember that in areas where God has given us liberty, where God has not spoken clearly about something, though it's important for me as an individual disciple of the Lord to have a personal conviction about that matter, I can't bind my conviction on others as though it's a rule God has made. An example of this could be found in Romans chapter 14. Turn there with me real quick. In Romans chapter 14, in verse 1, Paul says, "Now accept the one who's weak in faith, but not for the purpose of passing judgment on his opinion. One person has faith that he may eat all things, but the one who is weak eats vegetables only." Now, real quick, let me just say this, because it's a little bit deceptive when he uses terms like weak or faith or something like that, and you get the impression that one is immature and one lacks knowledge or something. Really, what Paul is talking about here when he uses the term weak and strong is the idea of one who is more restrictive in their practice. That's the weak brother. The one who will do less. And the stronger brother is the one whose conscience allows him to do more. Okay? But both brethren in this situation, the specific thing, whether they eat meats or vegetables only, are both right with God. One is not wrong and the other right. They're both right with God. One is less restrictive and one is more restrictive in their practice on this particular topic. But notice what he says in verse 3. The one who eats, that is the one who's less restrictive, is not to regard with contempt the one who does not eat, the one who's more restrictive in their practice. And the one who does not eat is more restrictive than their practice is not to judge the one who eats, who's less restrictive. Why? For God has accepted him. And here's the lesson that we need to learn. Verse 4. Who are you to judge the servant of another? To his own master he stands or falls, and he will stand, for the Lord is able to make him stand. Brethren, when we go around judging one another and declaring one another to be wrong or in sin because you do something different than the way that I want to do it, I am stepping outside my role as a disciple of the Lord, and I'm actually beginning to play God. And this is something that James, in James chapter 4, warns us against. Go with me to this one last passage, and the lesson will be yours. James chapter 4, beginning in verse 11, James says, "Do not speak against one another, brethren. He who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you're not a doer of the law, but a judge of it." He says, don't go judging one another in things that God has not definitively stated this is the only way it's going to be. Because when you do that, when you say, well, that's not my judgment in that area, and I think that if you don't do it the way I think you ought to do it, then you're wrong, then you're in sin. James is saying you have elevated yourself from being a doer of the law to the writer of the law. You are making up your own rules. But guess what? He says in verse 12, "There is only one lawgiver and judge, the one who's able to save and to destroy." And guess what? That's not you. That's not me. So who are you to judge your neighbor? Guys, I'm not saying that when God has clearly spoken on something that we need to hem and haw around it. If God said it, we point to his word on the matter and we say that's the end of the discussion. But in the areas where God has given us liberty to make a judgment call for ourselves, We must be extremely cautious in judging one another and going around and boldly declaring and often condemning others for their practice and saying that God said you're wrong for this. God calls you a sinner because you're doing this, when in fact God said no such thing. So before we go around boldly declaring what God said about something, we need to make sure that he actually said it. And don't presume to declare the mind of God on something or about someone for God. That was the mistake that Job's three friends made. And God said, you did not speak what is right concerning me, and therefore my wrath is kindled against you. And brothers, sisters, we need to make sure that we don't repeat the same mistake of Eliphaz, Zophar, and Bildad, and thus incur the wrath of God by speaking the wrong thing about him in our interaction and judgment of one another. That's a lesson that we can learn from Job's three friends.